Chapter 4. The long-tried Tupcom thought his employer demented, so utterly helpless was his appearance just then, and he went out reluctantly. No sooner was he gone than the squire, with great difficulty, stretched himself over to a cabinet by the bedside, unlocked it, and took out a small bottle. It contained a gout specific, against whose use he had been repeatedly warned by his regular physician, but whose warning he now cast to the winds. He took a double dose, and waited half an hour. It seemed to produce no effect. He then poured out a treble dose, swallowed it, leant back upon his pillow, and waited. The miracle he anticipated had been worked at last. It seemed as though the second draft had not only operated with its own strength, but had kindled into power the latent forces of the first. He put away the bottle, and rang up Tupcom. Less than an hour later, one of the housemaids, who of course was quite aware that the squire's illness was serious, was surprised to hear a bold and decided step descending the stairs from the direction of Mr. Dornell's room, accompanied by the humming of a tune. She knew that the doctor had not paid a visit that morning, and that it was too heavy to be the valet or any other manservant. Looking up, she saw Squire Dornell fully dressed, descending toward her in his drab caped riding coat and boots, with the swinging easy movement of his prime. Her face expressed her amazement. "What the devil beast looking at?" said the squire. "Did you never see a man walk out of his house before, wench?" Resuming his humming, which was of a defiant sort, he proceeded to the library, rang the bell, asked if the horses were ready, and directed them to be brought round. 10 minutes later he rode away in the direction of Bristol, Tupcom behind him, trembling at what these movements might portend. They rode on through the pleasant woodlands, and the monotonous straight lanes at an equal pace. The distance traversed might have been about 15 miles when Tupcom could perceive that the squire was getting tired, as weary as he would have been after riding 3 times the distance 10 years before. However, they reached Bristol without any mishap, and put up at the squire's accustomed inn. Dornell almost immediately proceeded on foot to the inn which Reynard had given as his address, it being now about 4 o'clock. Reynard had already dined, for people dined early then, and he was staying indoors. He had already received Mrs. Dornell's reply to his letter, but before acting upon her advice and starting for King's Hintock, he made up his mind to wait another day, that Betty's father might at least have time to write to him if so minded. The returned traveler much desired to obtain the squire's assent, as well as his wife's, to the proposed visit to his bride, that nothing might seem harsh or forced in his method of taking his position as one of the family. But though he anticipated some sort of objection from his father-in-law, in consequence of Mrs. Dornell's warning, he was surprised at the announcement of the squire in person. Stephen Reynard formed the completest of possible contrasts to Dornell as they stood confronting each other in the best parlor of the Bristol Tavern. The squire, hot-tempered, gouty, impulsive, generous, reckless. The younger man, pale, tall, sedate, self-possessed, a man of the world, fully bearing out at least one couplet in his epitaph, still extant in King's Hintock Church, which places in the inventory of his good qualities, engaging manners, cultivated mind, adorned by letters, and in courts refined. He was at this time about 35, though careful living and an even, unemotional temperament caused him to look much younger than his years. Squire Dornell plunged into his errand without much ceremony or preface. "I am your humble servant, sir," he said. "I have read your letter writ to my wife and myself, and considered that the best way to answer it would be to do so in person. I am vastly honored by your visit, sir," said Mr. Stephen Reynard, bowing. "Well, what's done can't be undone," said Dornell, "though it was mighty early, and was no doing of mine. She's your wife, and there's an end on't. But in brief, sir, she's too young for you to claim yet. We mustn't reckon by years, we must reckon by nature. She's still a girl. 'Tis unpolite of thee to come yet. Next year will be full soon enough for you to take her to you. Now, courteous as Reynard could be, he was a little obstinate when his resolution had once been formed. As he had been promised him by her 18th birthday at latest sooner, if she were in robust health. Her mother had fixed the time on her own judgment, without a word of interference on his part. He had been hanging about foreign courts till he was weary. Betty was now as woman, if she would ever be one, and there was not, in his mind, the shadow of an excuse for putting him off longer. Therefore, fortified as he was by the support of her mother, he blandly but firmly told the squire that he had been willing to waive his rights, out of deference to her parents, to any reasonable extent, but must now, in justice to himself and her, insist on maintaining them. He therefore, since she had not come to meet him, should proceed to King's Hintock in a few days to fetch her. This announcement, in spite of the urbanity with which it was delivered, set Dornell in a passion. Oh, damn it, sir, you talk about rights, you do, after stealing her away, a mere child, against my will and knowledge. If we begged and prayed thee to take her, you could say no more. Upon my honor, your charge is quite baseless, sir, said his son-in-law. You must know by this time, or if you do not, it has been a monstrous cruel injustice to me, that I should have been allowed to remain in your mind with such a stain upon my character. You must know that I used no seductiveness or temptation of any kind. Her mother assented. She assented. I took them at their word. That he was really opposed to the marriage was not known to me till afterwards. Dornell professed to believe not a word of it. You shan't have her till she's 3/6 full. No maid ought to be married till she's 3/6. And my daughter shan't be treated out of nater. So he stormed until Tupcombe, who had been alarmedly listening in the next room, entered suddenly, declaring to Reynard that his master's life was in danger if the interview were prolonged, he being subject to apoplectic strokes at these crises. Reynard immediately said that he would be the last to wish to injure Squire Dornell, and left the room, and as soon as the squire had recovered breath and equanimity, he went out of the inn, leaning on the arm of Tupcombe. Tupcombe was for sleeping in Bristol that night, but Dornell, whose energy seemed as invincible as it was sudden, insisted upon mounting, and getting back as far as Falls Park, to continue the journey to King's Hintock on the following day. At 5 they started, and took the southern road toward the Mendip Hills. The evening was dry and windy, and, excepting that the sun did not shine, strongly reminded Tupcombe of the evening of that March month, nearly 5 years earlier, when news had been brought to King's Hintock Court of the child Betty's marriage in London, news which had produced upon Dornell such a marked effect for the worse ever since, and indirectly upon the household of which he was the head. Before that time the winters were lively at Falls Park, as well as at King's Hintock, although the squire had ceased to make it his regular residence. Hunting guests and shooting guests came and went, and open house was kept. Tupcombe disliked the clever courtier who had put a stop to this, by taking away from the squire the only treasure he valued. It grew darker with their progress along the lanes, and Tupcombe discovered from Mr. Dornell's manner of riding that his strength was giving way, and spurring his own horse close alongside, he asked him how he felt. Oh, bad, damn bad, Tupcombe. I can hardly keep my seat. I shall never be any better, I fear. Have we passed 3 Man Gibbet yet? Not yet by a long ways, sir. I wish we had. I can hardly hold on. The squire could not repress a groan now and then, and Tupcombe knew he was in great pain. I wish I was underground. That's the place for such fools as I. I'd gladly be there, if it were not for Mistress Betty. He's coming on to King's Hintock. Tomorrow he won't put it off any longer. He'll set out and reach there tomorrow night, without stopping at Falls. And he'll take her unawares, and I want to be there before him. ... I hope you may be well enough to do it, sir. But really, I must, Tupcombe. You don't know what my trouble is. It is not so much that she is married to this man without my agreeing, for, after all, there's nothing to say against him, so far as I know, but that she don't take to him at all, seems to fear him in fact, cares nothing about him, and if he comes forcing himself into the house upon her, why, 'twill be rank cruelty. Would to the Lord something would happen to prevent him. How they reached home that night Tupcombe hardly knew. The squire was in such pain that he was obliged to recline upon his horse, and Tupcombe was afraid every moment lest he would fall into the road. But they did reach home at last, and Mr. Dornell was instantly assisted to bed. Next morning it was obvious that he could not possibly go to King's Hintock for several days at least, and there on the bed he lay, cursing his inability to proceed on an errand so personal and so delicate that no emissary could perform it. What he wished to do was to ascertain from Betty's own lips if her aversion to Reynard was so strong that his presence would be positively distasteful to her. Were that the case, he would have borne her away bodily on the saddle behind him. But all that was hindered now, and he repeated 100 times in Tupcombe's hearing, and in that of the nurse and other servants, "I wish to God something would happen to him." This sentiment, reiterated by the squire as he tossed in the agony induced by the powerful drugs of the day before, entered sharply into the soul of Tupcombe, and of all who were attached to the house of Dornell, as distinct from the house of his wife at King's Hintock. Tupcombe, who was an excitable man, was hardly less disquieted by the thought of Reynard's return than the squire himself was. As the week drew on, and the afternoon advanced at which Reynard would in all probability be passing near Falls on his way to the court, the squire's feelings became acuter, and the responsive Tupcombe could hardly bear to come near him. Having left him in the hands of the doctor, the former went out upon the lawn, for he could hardly breathe in the contagion of excitement caught from the employer who had virtually made him his confidant. He had lived with the Dornells from his boyhood, had been born under the shadow of their walls. His whole life was annexed and welded to the life of the family in a degree which has no counterpart in these latter days. He was summoned indoors, and learned that it had been decided to send for Mrs. Dornell. Her husband was in great danger. There were 2 or 3 who could have acted as messenger, but Dornell wished Tupcombe to go, the reason showing itself when, Tupcombe being ready to start, Squire Dornell summoned him to his chamber and leaned down, so that he could whisper in his ear, "Put Peggy along smart, Tupcombe, and get there before him, you know before him. This is the day he fixed. He has not passed Falls Crossroads yet. If you can do that, you will be able to get Betty to come, do you see? After her mother has started, she'll have a reason for not waiting for him. Bring her by the lower road, he'll go by the upper. Your business is to make 'em miss each other, do you see? But that's a thing I couldn't write down." 5 minutes after, Tupcombe was astride the horse, and on his way the way he had followed so many times since his master, a florid young countryman, had first gone wooing to King's Hintock Court. As soon as he had crossed the hills in the immediate neighborhood of the manor, the road lay over a plain, where it ran in long straight stretches for several miles. In the best of times, when all had been gay in the united houses, that part of the road had seemed tedious. It was gloomy in the extreme now that he pursued it, at night and alone, on such an errand. He rode and brooded. If the squire were to die, he, Tupcombe, would be alone in the world and friendless, for he was no favorite with Mrs. Dornell, and to find himself baffled, after all, in what he had set his mind on, would probably kill the squire. Thinking thus, Tupcombe stopped his horse every now and then, and listened for the coming husband. The time was drawing on to the moment when Reynard might be expected to pass along this very route. He had watched the road well during the afternoon, and had inquired of the tavern keepers as he came up to each, and he was convinced that the premature descent of the stranger husband upon his young mistress had not been made by this highway as yet. Besides the girl's mother, Tupcombe was the only member of the household who suspected Betty's tender feelings towards young Phillipson, so unhappily generated on her return from school, and he could therefore imagine, even better than her fond father, what would be her emotions on the sudden announcement of Reynard's advent that evening at King's Hintock Court. So he rode and rode, desponding and hopeful by turns. He felt assured that, unless in the unfortunate event of the almost immediate arrival of her son-in-law at his own heels, Mrs. Dornell would not be able to hinder Betty's departure for her father's bedside. It was about 9 o'clock that, having put 20 miles of country behind him, he turned in at the lodge gate nearest to Ivel and King's Hintock village, and pursued the long north drive itself much like a turnpike road which led thence through the park to the court. Though there were so many trees in King's Hintock Park, few bordered the carriage roadway. He could see it stretching ahead in the pale nightlight like an unrolled deal shaving. Presently the irregular frontage of the house came in view, of great extent, but low, except where it rose into the outlines of a broad square tower. As Tupcombe approached he rode aside upon the grass, to make sure, if possible, that he was the first comer, before letting his presence be known. The court was dark and sleepy, in no respect, as if a bridegroom were about to arrive. While pausing he distinctly heard the tread of a horse upon the track behind him, and for a moment despaired of arriving in time. Here, surely, was Reynard. Pulling up closer to the densest tree at hand he waited, and found he had retreated nothing too soon, for the second rider avoided the gravel also, and passed quite close to him. In the profile he recognized young Phillipson. Before Tupcombe could think what to do, Phillipson had gone on, but not to the door of the house. Swerving to the left, he passed round to the east angle, where, as Tupcombe knew, were situated Betty's apartments. Dismounting, he left the horse tethered to a hanging bough, and walked on to the house. Suddenly his eye caught sight of an object which explained the position immediately. It was a ladder stretching from beneath the trees, which there came pretty close to the house, up to a first floor window, one which lighted Miss Betty's rooms. Yes, it was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.